from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Museum Courtyard in downtown Lihue. There will be a Portuguese bread oven cooking demonstration and exhibit. Fresh foods will include malasadas, sweetbread, and spicy bean soup. Also, live music, dancing, arts, and crafts. Learn about Portuguese history and culture on Kauai. Enter a drawing to win a quarter hind of a cow. Information and tickets are available by calling 245-6931, online at kauaimuseum.org, or at the museum office.
Announcing the Reach Basketball Clinic, July 10th through 12th at the Kilauea Gym. Open to all boys and girls aged 9 to 18. This three-day basketball clinic has two purposes. To help participants excel as individuals and as a team through teaching the fundamentals of basketball, and to instruct, encourage, and minister life application skills. With former professional player Rick Harville and Harlem Globetrotter Sherwin Durham, scholarships are available. That's the Reach Basketball Clinic at the Kilauea Gym, Thursday through Saturday, July 10th, 11th, and 12th. More information from Mike at 346-2926, or you can pick up an application at the Calvary Church North Shore in Kilauea.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
Yeah, but they're not here.
Oh, but you're here.
Yeah, I'm here.
And you're here, too. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Out of the Box, one of the several wonderful public affairs shows here, a call-in talk show. We try and cover issues of import to the island and the world, and have a little fun, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are we doing in the show today?
Well, we're going to touch on current events near and far, and then we're going to have an interview with independent journalist and unembedded war correspondent Dar Jamel. He's going to try and give us an update, help us understand a little better just what in the heck is going on in Iraq. Because Iraq's been back in the news lately, but doesn't seem like good news.
And he should know what's going on there. He went to the war there on his own.
On his own. On his own dime.
While the bullets were flying, and he took his chances, and he went in there and reported on what he saw down there.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting story, and I look forward to talking with him. He's always very entertaining and informed. So that should be a really good... I'm really excited about that interview.
Yeah, so that'll be coming up at 5 o'clock. Phone lines will be open until then. We'll talk with Dar for a little while before we take calls from while he's on the air. But 826-7771, if anybody has any news, information, comments, anything that they want to bring on the air.
Sure, any updates, any important... upcoming social events, meetings, community issues, all kinds of good stuff going on this island. If you know some of it, please call in 826-7771 and let the rest of the island know. One thing I wanted to tell people about is there's been some political forums recently. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's little plastic rectangular signs popping up on the side of the road all over the island, and that means it's election season again. So we did a broadcast last night of a live forum, and there's going to be one coming up next week. And we'll give you some more information about that a little later in the show.
Okay. And mahalos to KKCR for broadcasting that that talk or that forum.
Yeah, forum. It was sort of abbreviated for folks who got a chance to listen to it. We can talk about that in a little bit.
Okay. And let's see... in the meantime, I think we do have a caller.
Yes, it's Joey with an update on yesterday's candidate.
Oh, good.
Okay, great.
Good. I'd love to get some your impressions of that. What did you think of that candidate forum last night, caller?
Is that me you're talking to?
Yes. Aloha. Welcome. Oh, you're on the air.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I was there live, and it was super informative. You know, it was sort of a meet and greet with the candidate. I felt that each of the candidates for mayor had very good answers to the questions that were given to them. And I think at first it was kind of confusing because they asked a question with Hendrix Lake, who was first, and then I think when it came to Dustin, who was next, he thought it was going to be the same question, but then they threw the curveball and gave him a different question, and then, you know, I could just tell on the expression on his face that, oh, okay.
Yeah, the way they chose to structure the event was a little curious, I thought. First off, because there were so many candidates running for the council, literally 20 people, that in order to get through everybody, all the mayor candidates, all the candidates for the House seat for the 15th district, they spent about, I don't know what, 11 and a half minutes talking to each person total?
Probably, so it's kinda, it went by quickly. I mean, it went by really quickly.
Yeah, actually, I thought it went by so quickly. It was kind of astonishing. It seemed like they were asking people for their closing statement only minutes after it had begun. I thought that was kind of odd.
But
I do think it's really wonderful that that we had an opportunity to hear at least something. And there's going to be more.
Yeah, and I thought that they all did really well. You know, it was a little bit humorous with the county council with Silly Billy and that darling Japanese lady, and I don't recall her name because she spoke so softly, I didn't quite get it, but she was just the loveliest person. She was the last person speaking on the low of the county council seat.
Yeah, I think she definitely won most adorable, if that was a category.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought, you know, Felicia was extremely precise and you know, she's just an Akamai lady when it comes to knowing what's going on and issues that we are facing as an island. I think she, in my opinion, is an excellent choice as a new candidate running. I spoke with Arthur Bruin afterwards and asked him a couple questions. I don't think he and I see eye to eye on, you know, I mean, I was appreciative of his time, but on the GMO issue, I asked him about, I think we feel differently about it. But I did say to him, if we were to grow hemp, industrial hemp, and he said, great, if that's what you guys want to plant for the future, I think that's a great idea. But for now, they didn't want to give up, you know, or have GMO kicked out until that process was put in place.
Did you have any other impressions from the evening?
I was happy with Dustin Barca. I don't think he got to, you know, enough time in, but, you know, I think we got to hear what he was about, you know, a little bit. You know, it was just so brief. I thought that our Mayor Carballo actually had a lot of good answers for what on what's working or what's in the works, but I can't believe everything that he said. I feel like he was trying to sugarcoat things just because he knows he's up against a tough battle unexpectedly.
Yeah, it should be interesting. The mayor's, I guess, the top two contenders in the primary, which is coming up pretty soon, they'll advance to the general. And then of the 20 candidates running for the council, the top 14 finishers will advance to the general election.
Yeah, it's scary for me as a person that likes to think along more organic terms and likes to, you know, not use pesticides. The thing that Arthur Bruin brought up is, why is it just the seed companies and not the golf courses and the county? And I go, hey, I'd like to see all those guys included too. So anyway, we do have a lot of work ahead of us coming together, and I think we are. But I'll get off the air and let somebody else call in, and I really appreciate you guys broadcasting it, even though I was there live. It was wonderful that you could do that for the people that couldn't make it.
I think KKCR is very, very happy to be able to do that. And not only does it bring the forum to people who can't go to the forum themselves, but it also helps reduce the traffic on the island. Because you can listen to the candidates talk without having to get in your car and clog up the roads.
And that's one of the things, the question that was brought up. But anyway, well, hopefully some other callers can call in.
All right, well, thank you very much, caller.
Thank you. Aloha.
For folks who missed that candidate forum, I believe that it is archived on the KKCR website at kkcr.org. And is it up yet? Oh, fantastic. So,
on our Facebook page.
Oh, okay.
Right now it's
on
the computer, so it'll be on the website tomorrow.
Okay, so within the next 24 hours, you can go to the kkcr.org website, click on archive, and then you'll be able to find the file and listen to yourself on demand.
A lot of our old shows are on there also.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, a lot of the talk shows get posted on there.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I should go check out that archive. I think there's some cool stuff in there.
What, I heard this guy Jonathan Jay's on there too.
Eh, I don't know about that guy. if you are interested in the next forum coming up, it's going to be also broadcast live. It's going to be Monday, July 14th next week, and Tuesday. We've got two coming up, and those are both going to be out in the West Side. Let's see. It's going to be in the historic Waimea Theater starting at 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. On Monday, it'll be the mayoral candidates and State House of Representatives District 16. That's D. Morikawa and whoever else is running on the West Side. And then on Tuesday, also at 6 p.m., is going to be all the county council candidates. So that actually seems like a better arrangement than what we saw last night, kind of dividing it out.
Hey, we have another caller. Let's go to the phones. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it?
Good.
Yeah, I tuned in a little bit for that last night, your live broadcast of the thing at the War Memorial.
How was the audio quality?
Peace and Freedom Hall.
Yeah, I must have caught it at the beginning, kind of when was it, Senator or Congressman Tokioka or something was talking?
Let's see, he's a State House representative.
Okay, well, I just had to turn off because I felt like it was such rhetoric, you know? I mean, the stuff he was saying was like years what someone would have said a couple years. He's not caught up with the real current issues that face our island, and that's why I wanted to call in is I mean, our reefs are dying, and just today I seen on Oahu a whole bunch of fish washed up on the beach dead.
What was it that he said that you heard that made you concerned?
Oh, it was just political rhetoric, you know. I mean, I know when someone's talking cliches and when someone's got real solutions and real, you know, I mean, I don't know.
Can you recall an example?
I can. I'm sorry, I can't.
All right, that's your impression.
Yeah, I turned it off. I mean, I posted, I said, you know, I'll vote this year, I'll vote, but I don't know. It's there's not a whole lot of people that I got a lot of trust in, and I don't know that voting for someone that you think is going to do the job is going to help anyhow, because there's just so much going on right now. Back to the three issue, please. You know, I'd like to bring in Terry Lilly and some of these other guys that are, you know, scientists that can show that the rim pack and that these microwaves and everything like this is having an impact on our fishing industry. You know, I mean, I've lived here 20-something years, 27 years, and over the last 10 years, it's a shame. Like when you go out and you dive and you used to see schools of fish, it's bad. It's really bad. You know, now the whole world knows about it. You know, it made the news that which is, going to be broadcast around the world. It's world news now that Hanalei reefs are dying. So somebody better step up to the plate and go, ooh, we got to fix this, you know. Right off the bat in my mind is, you know, an immediate solution might be to put a total warranty stop, kapu, on any set net in that area. And then the next thing is, if the reefs are dying that bad, I think we should sterilize some junk cars and pin them down to the bottom of the ocean and give the reef a chance to grow back onto, you know. That's been done in Australia. That's been done other parts of the world where areas of reef are dying.
Right. Hey, but we got some more callers behind you. You got any closing comments?
I'm a little disgusted in our political system, tell you the truth.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Aloha, caller. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in to Out of the Box.
Okay. Yeah. I am a Democrat. My name is Anthony. I am, second caller, a little disgusted with the Democrat Party right now. They show no respect for the people. If you came out to the 4th of July fireworks over here on this side, you will see all their signs out there in front of that chemical company, Dow Chemical Company. They had about 10 signs out there. It started with Neil Abercrombie, and it ended up with Arthur Bruin. So we know who they are. They are all for the corporate America. And it's not the United States of corporate America, it's the United States of America. And I went by, I had to go to work, I came back by it, it was still up. You know what? I took out my pair of wire cutters and I cut all those signs down. They were all in right of way.
So that's kind of direct democracy there, taking things into your own hands.
Well, it's the wrong thing to do. I should not have done that, but they made me so angry that I just did it. And two wrongs do not make a right.
I've heard that said, yeah. You might be right about that.
They were in the right of way, and I should not have cut it down. I admit to that. But if you're going to stop me from cutting down and maliciously causing them damage, then you have to arrest the candidate, because according to the candidate's handbook, they are responsible for all the signage that goes up. And clearly, the candidate handbook says in the last paragraph, no signs in the right of way. I know. I looked it up. I was going to run for office. I said, hey, I go say, but they give me a handbook. Yeah, and there it says.
How did you make a determination of whether it was in the roadway or not?
It's right there between two telephone poles, and you got telephone wires right above. I think that's the right of way. That is the right of way. I was being facetious and sarcastic there. That is the right of way, because beyond the telephone pole in either direction, 10 feet, that's when the right of way ends.
Well, perhaps
and that was Dow Chemical.
Perhaps no. This is a good opportunity for any candidates who are listening to remind them to not put their signs in the right of way, or else
we know better.
Somebody
know.
Like you might just come along and help them out.
Cut them down again. If that shows no respect for the people of Kauai, no respect for the laws as we know. And that goes for Democrats and Republicans, because you can drive around and you see, what's his name, running for the governor's one on the Republican ticket?
Republican for governor. Yeah, Duke Iona.
Duke Iona. His signs are bordering on the right of way and on private property. And he's got some humongous signs.
Yeah, he does have big signs. I've seen
his
signs.
That's his. He got money, so they'll have to do it there.
Well, you know what they say.
No respect for the people of Kauai, no respect for the Hawaii law. That's what we have to deal with. That's what we got to look at. So people, when you go out and vote, make an intelligent vote. Don't vote for any of the same old things. Vote for somebody new. And if there is nobody new, then we're stuck with the lesser of two evils.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, caller. Appreciate that.
Okay, phone lines are open, 826-7771. In the news, I'm going to read a little news here while we're waiting for some more calls. I've got a daughter who lives over in Portland. I get Oregon news all the time.
Dave, that's not news that you have a daughter.
I haven't gotten to the news part yet.
Okay.
They've got a GMO labeling bill that's likely to get on the ballot to turn in their signatures. Hopefully, it'll all be approved, and Oregon may be the next state to require labeling of GMO products in foods. And right now, the polling going at 77% in favor of that. Although a similar bill was defeated 2 or 3 years ago in Oregon, when a huge push by the GMO companies, seed companies, convinced them that it wasn't in their best interests.
Yeah, you got to be careful sometimes about the polls. You know, people say, oh, the polls say this, the polls say that. But if the election's in Oregon, then it doesn't really matter so much what the polls say. It matters more what the Oregonians have to say, right?
Yeah, well, they polled the Oregonians, not the Polish people.
Oh, okay.
But then also they have a referendum on there to not allow the addition of fluoride in the water.
Huh. See,
currently, they don't allow fluoride in the water there in Portland. But the county or the city council approved a measure without much debate or ability for the population to give their input on it. And they passed it saying that they're going to allow it. But so now this referendum, it says they cannot put any industrial waste in their drinking water.
Oh, and I think that the
that's where the fluoride comes from.
Definable,
it's a waste comes from industrial processes. And so they'll basically short-circuit the process and just say, oh, no industrial waste. You can put fluoride in if you want to find a cleaner source of it, but we're not going to let you put hazardous waste in our water.
Isn't fluoride actually have a very high toxicity?
Well, it is toxic, yeah, and that is underplayed by the people that want to see it in there. The companies that sell fluoride, they want to see it in there, you know. Huh. So
I mean, how good of an idea is it to put something that's highly toxic into your drinking water?
Well, they always tout the health benefits. That.
So what's the health benefit of the highly toxic
thing? Well, they say that it reduces cavities in children, but although there's no real science to back that up.
Huh.
That they say, hey, fluoride's good for tooth enamel, so put it in the water. You should, but although there's no real good studies that show that you absorb it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that if you go into the dentist and they, you know, take some fluoride gel and apply it to your teeth, as opposed to, like, drinking the fluoride.
Right. Yeah.
That actually helps your teeth.
Yeah, and so if they start putting fluoride in the water, then what's next? You know, vitamins, aspirin, you know, they can throw all kinds of stuff in there that has some health benefit, you know, but...
Yeah, I'm not really clear on the health benefit of the toxic industrial waste material going in the water. You haven't really convinced me on that one.
Yeah,
no.
Phone lines are open there, 826-7771. So hopefully the folks in Oregon there will wake up this time and do the right thing.
I want to let you know that in terms of our upcoming election, that you still have time to do your absentee application for registering. Let's see. The primary is going to be July 28th to August 7th. And you can, if you're already registered, you can register as an absentee by August 2nd. That's Saturday. So you've got a couple weeks for that. If you haven't registered yet at all, you should hustle on down. If you have access to internets, you can go to hawaii.gov/elections. Or let's see. Here on Kauai, here's the number to call. You ready? Got a piece of paper? Pencil? 241-4800. And that's the County Clerk of Kauai, the County of Kauai Elections Division. Again, that number is 241-4800. Tell them you want to register to vote, and they will help you out.
Cool. I think we have a phone call now. Let's go to the phones. Aloha, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to add to the last caller's comments about the governor's race. Governor Abercrombie, actually, it was something I just listened to, the old governor Ariyoshi said that Abercrombie, he put up those buildings in Kaka'ako against the people's will, and it's all corporate money from the mainland. It has nothing to do with keeping any money here, and people didn't even want it there, and that's what we're dealing with, and that's what we don't want to have here on Kauai. All this corporate buildings, you know, that people build that other people don't really want. We want to try and keep it really country but, you know, improve the roads and everything at the same time. But there's, you know, and growing our own agriculture. And that's what Justin Barker was talking about in his 2 minutes that he had to answer a question. He would like to see us be more sustainable and grow our own food, because 90% of our food is being imported. And if we ever do have a disaster, and this is his words, that we'd be better prepared to be able to feed our own people rather than depend on things being shipped in.
Well, I guess that's a good idea if you like eating.
I like eating. Yeah. Okay, well, anyway, I'm hoping other people will call in. You know, you guys always have a great show. Thank you. And the other thing is, Arthur Bruin did say that he wanted to allow the state to decide our pesticide. He was against 2491, our pesticide issues, you know. And I said that I don't agree with him. I told him, I said that we need to be more in control over our own county, not the state be in control over us. So anyway, thank you for your time.
All right. Yeah, thank you, caller.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's see. Phone lines are open again.
Well, here's an item, and perhaps if somebody from the, the Kauai Chamber of Commerce, I believe, if you guys can give some information about that, that'd be fantastic. I had in my hands another charter amendment petition that's been going around, and this is, Randy Francisco, Karen Ono, Karen Taketa, Jerry Ornelius, and Lori Ho. Are the five named persons who are promoting this charter amendment. And this is, we the undersigned registered voters of this petition support changing the number of signatures required on a petition for a county charter amendment to raise it from 5% of the total number of registered voters to 20% of the total number of registered voters in the previous election. What that basically means is if you want to get an issue on the ballot, you have to go around and gather signatures to do it.
So what would 20% of the electorate be?
Roughly
60,000. Maybe
there's like roughly 40,000. Yeah.
So it'd be 8,000 signatures.
Yeah, 8,000 or 9,000. That would be 20%. And then of course, that's four times higher than 5%. So what they're basically saying is they think it should be four times harder for people who live here, like you and me, and actually everyone who lives here, make it four times harder for you to participate in creating the laws of your own local self-governance. Some people, these people evidently, think it's already too easy for people to participate in their own self-governing process, and they want to make it four times harder to do.
Have you heard any justification for that? I mean, has there been abuses of that process in the past? I mean, things that are frivolous that waste people's time or, I mean, I can't think of any. It's not used very often.
No, it doesn't happen very often. But the thing about it is actually quite curious because I don't really understand how someone's time can be wasted by bringing a question and putting it before the people and having them vote yes or no about it. That's actually fundamental to our whole democratic process.
Right. It was brought up during the KIUC debates when there was a couple of measures that were brought to the KIUC membership. Mm-hmm. Relating to smartphones, I think initially.
No, smart meters.
Smart meters, I'm sorry. Smart meters. And it was voted down, and some said, well, what a waste of time and money on the part of the utility that was because it was voted down. But I don't see it that way.
How is it a waste of time or money for people to gather together and make determinations about what they do or don't want to do? I mean, that's kind of like the whole point of it, right?
That's right. I mean, it should be. Now, some think that, I mean, legislators in particular think that they should be the ones that are making the laws and people should not have the right to do so.
Why do you think that would be a legitimate position? Like, I'm the legislator, so I'm supposed to legislate, so you can't?
Well, I mean, I don't believe it, but I've heard that said. Other people have brought that up.
Huh.
So I don't really have a justification for it. Maybe you're not smart enough to write a good law.
I am actually not that smart, Dave.
And maybe that legislator, people that are elected are smarter than you and
There's
I
a
are.
Lot of people who are smarter than I am. That's true.
And so maybe we should allow them to do it. But that does, just because you write something doesn't mean it's going to pass. I mean, you've got to convince
the majority
of the people to vote for it.
Right.
So it's not like everything frivolously goes through and becomes law.
Well, unless the people want it to be that way, and if the people want it to be that way, then that's called, what's that called?
Democracy, maybe? Something like that?
Yeah. Representative. Yeah, I think that's right.
No, that
wouldn't
be
representative democracy.
That would be direct democracy. Representative is when you hire somebody else or elect somebody else to vote for you. Yeah.
Yeah, these are surprisingly confusing notions for some people.
Yeah, maybe we should try to get some of those folks on the air and find out what their rationalization is for changing this. I mean, so that is, I guess, in the county charter, I would imagine, that dictates how many people are required. Now, there's something else that came up with the recent pesticide bill, referendum, that when they submitted it, because you only need 5% for
a county charter amendment.
A county charter amendment, but you need 20% for some other type of
referendums and initiatives.
Okay, so there was a question: is this a referendum or initiative, or is it a county charter amendment, or
right.
what? So
right. And I think perhaps some of the motivation for raising the limit from 5% to 20% is so that they'll both be the same, so that it doesn't matter if it's an initiative or an amendment, because honestly, most people can't really decide which ones. I mean, it's unnecessarily confusing. Why would there be two different thresholds you have to meet for signature gathering? Why can't it all just be the same thing?
Why can't they both be 5%?
That's a good question.
Rather than both 20.
Yeah, that's a good question. That would make more sense to me. That would clean up the discrepancy, eliminate the confusion, and make it easy for people to participate in their own self-governance. Yeah. How about that?
I believe that's done quite a bit in Switzerland, where they regularly vote on a wide variety of very important issues.
But they're pretty smart. They're pretty smart in Switzerland. They're probably smarter than I am.
Maybe some of them are, but
I'm certain
that is definitely a good idea.
Huh. Maybe we're not smart enough to do that here.
So do you think this measure will pass? I mean, do you think it's you can convince 51% of the populace or the electorate to
give away their rights to participate in their own process? It's possible.
I mean, it's not so far-fetched. When you put it that way, it kind of sounds bad, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they'll spin it much differently.
Yeah, I suppose there are people who will vote against themselves. Like,
oh, yeah,
I don't
yeah.
think I should have the right to do that. I want to take that away from me.
That's right. You know, with the pesticide bill, I don't think we should have the right to regulate pesticides. We think somebody else should do that, maybe the state.
Yeah, we shouldn't even have the right to decide if we want to do that or not. That shouldn't be up to us.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it kind of sounds like they're talking about there.
Hmm.
We're not smart enough to figure out what's good for our own interests.
Well, how about you, listener? Are you smart enough to give us a call in here at 826-7771 and let you know, let us know, and let everyone on the island know what you think about what we've been talking about, or if you have a new topic you want to introduce here on Out of the Box at KKCR.
Hey, I got some good news here out of Germany, and it doesn't have to do with the World Cup soccer match either, but there's a growing movement in Germany called the End the Fed movement. They've been doing rallies in hundreds of cities throughout Europe, mostly Germany, Austria, Switzerland, some in Canada and Australia, where they are pushing to end the Federal Reserve Bank and close the central banking system of the world.
Of Germany or of the U.S.?
Of the world. You know, I mean, the Fed is part of a group of large financial institutions that are all run by a small group of people.
Run by the feds, aren't they?
The feds, no.
Oh.
No, it's
sneaky.
It's a private corporation.
Huh.
Supposedly not for profit,
but
you know,
actually
it doesn't work that way.
Entirely
you know?
For profit?
Entirely for profit.
Huh.
And self-interest. So anyway, the Fed and the central banks, which are in every country in the world except for Syria, Iran, North Korea, used to be Libya, but they got taken over, and one of the first actions after the Libyan government fell was to open up a central bank. So that was probably...
I'm guessing they don't have a lot of ATMs in Syria or North Korea that are functioning right now. I'm just guessing.
No, I think you'd be surprised about that. No, it is a functioning society, although there is a civil war going on, or there is a military action. They're being invaded. But anyway, so there's big movement going on.
That's a really
now.
Kind way to and, say it, Dave.
And so this movement is growing. They're saying the banking system is corrupt and causes many of the problems of the world, including wars, because they are kind of pushing their agenda through wars. And so this is actually good news, I believe. This is something I've been asking for a long time, but it's weird that it started in Germany now.
Yeah, I don't quite. Do you know why that is?
Just some individuals took it upon themselves to do that, but it seems to be, they're opening chapters in the U.S., and there should be a growing number of people in this country and maybe some political actions around that issue. But I think if we could somehow eliminate that banking system, then a lot of other problems in the world would go away, because they basically siphon off 50% of all the money from every transaction in the planet.
That's a pretty high service fee.
It is.
Can you cite your source for 50%?
50%?
Yeah, can you cite your source for that?
Because
then, neither you nor I should make wild or outlandish claims that we can't actually support with evidence.
I mean, I don't have it right here, but I will stand by that. I've seen studies that show the ownership of all the corporations in the world and how they basically take in 50% of the assets of the world, and these corporations are owned by the same people that own the central banks and the Federal Reserve. So, you know, I think it's a fair number, fair percentage of the, basically they just suck off half of the assets of the planet, and But I can try to find a source for you, but it's something I've put together from many different studies.
Well, I just always think it's really helpful to anyone who's listening or wants to do further research on the matter themselves or, you know, double check on us, yeah?
Yeah, and, you know, you've heard of the BRICS Bank.
BRICS.
Just B-R-I-C-S.
Brazil,
Russia, India, China. In South Africa.
Okay.
And, well, they just opened up a bank to compete with the central banking system, funded it with $100 billion worth of not dollars. So the whole thing is going to be run to as a development bank for the third world, but it's not going to use U.S. dollars, the reserve currency of the world, the former reserve currency of the world. Anyway, so so that is underway now and is going to compete with the central bank system and could be its downfall as well.
So a potential tectonic shift in the financial world of the planet.
Right.
Huh. That'd be interesting.
Hey, well, I think we have a couple of calls here now. Let's go to the phones.
Aloha, caller. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in to Out of the Box. Do you have a question or a comment on what we've been talking about?
Yes. Aloha, gentlemen. A question. Do we have a barter system existing on Kauai?
Well, what do you got? You got a cow?
Well, in terms of like either real objects exchanged for real objects of value, or some kind of like some communities, I believe on the east coast of the U.S. have created their own money systems or exchange systems involving pieces of paper, which I guess serve as
symbols of value.
Yes, I'm glad you said that.
Oh, thank you.
So yes, we don't have a movement in that regard.
I'm not aware of any barter networks here on the island. I mean, obviously, a lot of people do trade this and that.
Yeah, stuff and
like
things.
Light cheese for your Ono, your Ahi, whatever. But there have been attempts in the past. I'm not aware of any right now. Maybe some callers have that information.
Yeah, some Akamai caller out there is aware of a local barter network system. You can call in at 826-7771 and trade your information.
And then a comment briefly about the central bank phenomena.
Yeah.
I think if you look at the whole history starting in the U.S. of the Fed and central banks, I think it's been pretty much downhill for the average person in terms of their real wealth. And freedom ever since that point.
Yeah, certainly if you look at the value of the U.S. dollar, it is down to about 2 cents. You know, it takes a dollar to buy what 2 cents bought 100 years ago.
Yeah, and I think that when you look at what happened with the funds, you know, after the 2008 banking crisis, when the analysis came out, you know, how come that we gave all this money to these European banks?
I think because they asked very nicely for it.
Oh, really?
I think that's the main reason.
Can I get in line for that?
No, it's because they're corrupt and they're the same people. They took care of their buddies.
Well, that's
not you and me.
That's actually a less nice way of saying the same thing I just did.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it seems that, you know, with the actions of the quantitative easing, in other words,
I love that. Can you explain to the listener what quantitative easing, what that means? I love that.
Well,
phrase.
I think it's like if I owed a bunch of money and I went to my wife and I said, "Don't worry, honey, I'm just going to print a bunch of money up in the basement, and then we're going to buy our own debts." And see, in this way, you know, we're not going to really. Yeah, we're going to still owe the money, but we're just going to, you know, keep the wolf from the door for as many years as possible. So whenever, you know, maybe we'll die before we have to, you know, reconcile this and pay everything back. And I mean, that's what quantitative easing is. We've been buying all these junk student loans and housing mortgages and all this crap. And then, of course, you and me, we could not get, you know, 0%. We could not borrow money at 0%, whereas the big boys, they have been able to borrow at 0%. So it's just
now, hold on a second, because we've got other callers standing by. So I wanted to thank you for calling in.
Okay.
And invite you to call back in a little while if the phones are quiet.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw my two cents in there.
Okay. All right. Hey, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
We do have a policy. We're trying to get as many calls as possible here, so kind of limiting it a little bit in that regard.
So thank you. Thank you for helping out that way.
Don't feel like we're cutting you off necessarily, but we want to. We've got a couple more people lined up to talk.
Oh, yeah, that's that nice dial tone. Well, so the last caller.
Just after I said that, all the phone lines went dead. I think our phone guy maybe pushed the wrong button. I don't know. We'll see about that. But
these two people called and hung up, and I didn't want to hang up on the guy while he was on.
Okay. Well, please call back if you were one of those that couldn't wait. 826-7771. Hey, if you're over in Oahu listening on one of our frequencies over there.
Which one, Dave?
Well, there's K284AL. That is 104.7. Or if you're on the North Shore, you can get us at 91.9 generally, maybe Haleiwa area, something
and,
like that.
You know? And no matter where you are in this watery world, you can go online and listen to us streaming live at kkcr.org.
So if you're out of our local phone calling area, then give us a call on our toll-free line. We'll even pay for that. And that number is 866-275-1112. We'd love to hear from you from wherever you are.
So here's a recent news story from Japan. You may recall, Dave, because I know you're pretty smart, that in 1946, after World War II, when the U.S. defeated the Japanese Imperial Armed Services, Armed Forces, they went over there and occupied Japan for a while, and Japan...
Oh, still do.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, yeah, we're still there.
Wow, that's kind of a long occupation. It's like a lifetime occupation.
Yeah, well, we're still occupying Germany.
Oh, yeah, you're right about that, too.
Korea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh, we're very busy.
Yeah, we are, we are.
So the Japanese came up with a new constitution under U.S. tutelage in the late 40s, and one of the key elements of their constitution was that they would be pacifist, that they would not it would not allow military action by Japanese forces for anything other than self-defense. So, but recently in the news a couple weeks ago, there has been a reinterpretation of the Japanese Constitution by the Japanese.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounded pretty clear-cut. I mean, self-defense, I mean, how do you misinterpret that in the first place?
Well, this is Article 9. It expressly disallows military solutions to the challenges that face them. It says, quote, "The Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat of or the use of force as a means to settling international disputes." Now, this was largely pushed on by the U.S. at the time, and the change now has also been largely pushed by the U.S. military.
Right.
Yeah, what the U.S. military would like now with this reinterpretation is they would like the Japanese defense forces to be able to operate in conjunction with U.S. forces. And so they could act in concert with each other. And previously, the Japanese could never fire their first shot. They would have to wait until they were attacked. That would be sort of the very essence of what defense is versus aggression. Right. But now they have this new phrase called collective security, where the Japanese won't be just responsible for their own security, their own defense, but the security and defense of their neighbors, of their allies. So they're kind of sliding down the street a little bit. So now if someone were to attack an ally of Japan, Japan would be able to defend against that. So it's an expansion of their military capacity, their realm of operation.
It sounds like it's completely in violation of the intent and wording of the original provision in the Constitution.
You know, you could be right about that, but it kind of boils down, I think, to this one word. Forever.
Forever.
Yeah. It says the Japanese people forever renounce war, blah, 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 blah.
Okay. So forever's gone, and we're past that. Now we're into a new world. And now
it turns out sometimes that forever actually isn't as long as you think it is. In fact, it's less than 70 years.
Yeah.
So I bet you didn't know that.
It's like, you know, people get married, you know, hey, I'll love you forever. It doesn't always work that way.
Yeah, 68 years. But you know what? Yeah. Because of this, it's actually cool in a way, because now it's entirely possible that you could live forever.
Forever.
Forever, yeah.
70 years.
Yeah, if you make it to 70, that's, yeah, according to the Japanese Constitution, that's forever.
Now, remember back in when we were ramping up for our Iraq war invasion?
Now, hold on a second. One of them. Hold on a second, because, you know, when people use pronouns like that, it always gets me confused. Do I remember when we were ramping up? No.
We were having this discussion about, let's get a coalition together, because if we just invade, if the U.S. invades then people will say, oh, hey, you guys are the aggressors. But if there's a coalition of people.
A coalition of the willing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they tried to get Japan to change their constitution at that time. So,
yeah.
Hey, you guys could send some troops in there and we'll have another name on our list of coalition members.
Of willing coalition members.
Willing coalition members. Well, they wouldn't have been all that willing, I guess, at that point if it's against their constitution. But anyway, they did not prevail at that time, but it sounds like they're getting their way. I mean, they're really pushing Japan to, you know, mix it up with China over the islands of Senjoku Islands or whatever those are.
Well, it's all those resource-rich areas in the South China Sea.
Right, yeah. And so the U.S. is pushing Japan to use military force, I guess, to defend those islands, even though, you know, it's not particularly in their best interest.
Or it's not really theirs.
With China.
Not really theirs to defend.
But then, you know, if somehow Japan gets mixed up with it, well, then we are under treaty to get involved as well. So it could be a backdoor.
Now, when you say we,
the United
States,
it's
so confusing, because I keep thinking that, like, you and I, Dave and Jonathan, are going to have to go.
But we never did that.
I never did.
No.
No.
And I used to say that, yes, well, you are responsible for what your government does, but, you know, it's not our government anymore. It's been taken over by a cabal of international bankers that decide who goes to war and who does not. So,
okay, now I'm going to ask you.
Not we.
I'm going to ask
it
you
is
again.
They. So now we can say.
I'm going to ask you again, Dave. What information can you cite to support that claim? That's a pretty outrageous claim. Not like necessarily false, but you're making a large claim there.
Okay, remember the study we talked about a few shows back that illustrated that the U.S. is not a representative republic; it is rather an oligarchy.
Sure, where the wealthy few seem to always get their way.
Right. That's my source. For
okay.
This.
Okay.
The wealthy bankers run the country.
Well, not just bankers.
Well,
you got weapons, defense contractors.
The same people.
You got financial services.
The same people.
You got the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
You know.
They're all the same. They're all the oligarchs. And so that is my source. Is we do not run this country anymore.
You and me.
They do. So now we can say they or the United States and not implicate ourselves in that.
Actually, that feels sort of freeing.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that actually gives me kind of a good feeling.
It's not your fault anymore.
Huh. Yeah, that's liberating.
Yeah. But it is kind of depressing, though, because you've lost something.
Well, I've lost culpability for bad things I'm not doing.
You've also lost your sovereignty.
Oh, yeah.
You no longer have control of your own government, your own armed forces anymore. So.
Well, you, and I don't mean you, Dave, I mean you, the listener, you have control over your own fingertips. And I don't know if you have a rotary phone, because some people have, you know, that little thing that goes
still,
around.
Are they still around?
I have one.
I haven't seen one in a while. You have one?
Yeah, it's black.
Tick, 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 tick,
yeah,
tick.
Yeah,
tick, 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 tick,
yeah.
Tick,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You're dating yourself, which is weird to do in public.
Yeah, I don't like to date myself.
Or you may have a touchtone phone, and the number is 826-7771. Please feel free to call in to Out of the Box and share your mana'o.
Yeah, somebody called in. It took a little while, though, for it to come through, so I think they were waiting for the rotary dial to come around again.
Could be. Is that caller ready to come on?
Maybe not.
Not quite yet. All right, well, what else you got, Dave?
Well, I hate to start into a whole new topic here when we have somebody.
Aloha, KKCR.
Yeah. I guess that guy wasn't ready to go. Okay, let's go to the phones. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I want to correct a misstatement you made about
Japanese people, you said, are wanting to get rid of Article 9, and that's not exactly true. Opinion polls over there show that by a 2-to-1 margin, they want to keep their pacifist Article 9.
Okay. Well, let's see. Jonathan, what is the source of your article there regarding the Japanese changing their constitution, or the interpretation of their constitution? There, we'll have to go back to the source on this one here. So the caller, you didn't have your headphones on. The caller is saying that...
I heard the question.
Oh, okay.
You can Google that. It's Article 9, Japanese Constitution, and the Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, yeah. He said that they're making a minimal way, that's his quote, of the change, the reinterpretation of the Japanese Constitution.
So he's doing it unilaterally and not going to the people to change that.
Right, and so then there's also kind of a stink, because there's actually a lot of resistance in the Japanese population, the Japanese community. They kind of like the whole pacifism thing, and many people in Japan want to keep it that way.
Okay, well, you got that part right. The Abe with the... U.S. Pushing him wants to do away with Article 9. The crux of the situation is that Japan does have an armaments industry, and that they're not able to sell to their own government because they don't have a big military.
Yeah, that's one of the tricky things about war, and I think that's one of the big, my opinion, it's one of the big reasons why we keep having wars, is because it's so dang profitable.
Yeah, but the real reason I called... I'd like to announce an event, if I might.
Please.
Okay. Day after tomorrow, on Saturday, there's going to be a panel discussion with input from the audience to follow. This is going to be at the Kapaa Library starting at 5 p.m. And the name of the event is The Unseen Wars on the Ocean. And this is to do with Jeju Island and Okinawa and RIMPAC 2014. And we have
and share with people what RIMPAC 2014 is.
Well,
I know it's a mouthful. It's a whole lot of stuff. But what's the short version?
I'll just say this: in an article in the Today's Star Advertiser, today they came up to the northwest side of Kauai, and that's where they're going to fire on some obsolete ships, and they're going to sink ships out there.
So who are they?
It's going to be military warships from 23 countries.
That's a lot of warships, yeah.
And plus their submarines and their warplanes. And so different arms manufacturers from different countries are going to get to put their weapons on display.
Kind of like a gigantic military trade show.
Exactly. So
it's more of a testing ground where you don't actually just get to see them in a brochure. You get to fire them off.
Yeah, you get to get your hands on the wheel and drive them around a little bit.
Yeah.
Test drive those weapon systems. And it's kind of exciting, too, because it's not just the U.S. Navy, but as you say, it's the navies of 23 different countries. Is that right?
That's right. And I'd like to...
So it's kind of like a gigantic party for military.
I'd like to complete my announcement for this event. This is a really important event. This is part of a series of panel discussions being put on by the Oceans for Peace Coalition. We have three experts. We have Jim Maragos. He's an expert on atoll ecology. He's been on more than 70 atolls all around the Pacific. We have Kenta Watanabe. He's a tropical botanist from come up to Kauai from Okinawa. And we have Catherine Music. She's a marine biologist. She's a resident here on the island. And they're going to be addressing coral reefs. And specifically, Mr. Maragos has just returned from Jeju Island, where South Korean government is building a Navy port, and Mr. Watanabe is very familiar with what's happening at Aura Bay in Okinawa, where there is proposed to be the coral reef to be landfilled and paved over. And in fact, if There's a flyer going around about this event, and if you've seen that flyer and you've seen that picture of that coral reef on the bottom of the flyer, that's Aura Bay. It's spectacular to say the least. So,
but they're gonna dredge it out and turn it into some sort of naval harbor.
It's not going to be a Navy base. It's going to be a runway, an airstrip for the the U.S. Marine Corps.
Hmm.
Yeah. So this event is day after tomorrow. It's Saturday, July 12. It's from 5 to 7 p.m., and it's happening at the Kapaa Library, and it's a free event.
Well, that sounds like that will be entertaining and an eyeful and informative.
These are first-hand accounts, eyewitness accounts with words and PowerPoints, and there will be ample opportunity after for people to share their manawa.
Well, thank you very much for calling in and letting people know about that. It sounds like an important and worthwhile event.
Mahalo.
Okay. Let's see, 4:57 here now. Why don't I take care of the top of the hour business and let you know that you're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, Kauai Community Radio. Oh, also there's K284AL in Haleiwa. And Out of the Box is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the following wonderful underwriters.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapaa, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
Neil Norman and the Hawaii Life Brokerage Ohana proudly supports GMO-free Kauai, agricultural biodiversity, and sustainable farming practices, such as community gardens, food forests, seed saving, and beekeeping. Malama aina.
Island Metals, Kauai's one-stop shop for all things metal roofing and siding. Manufacturing custom orders to your exact specifications in just 1 to 2 days. Right here on Kauai. Contractors and homeowners welcome. More information at 246-4600, online at islandmetals.com, or at our shop in Honolulu. At All Island Metals, we have you covered.
The 15th Annual Kaloa Plantation Rodeo Weekend at CJM Country Stables in Poipu begins Friday, July the 18th through Sunday, July the 20th. The team roping competition begins at 11 a.m. on Friday. Women's barrel racing begins at 4 and ends at 8:30 p.m. There will be a Paniolo barbecue and music by the Bootleggers and Not My First Rodeo. Sunday's rodeo and live music begins at 10:30 a.m. Paniolo and Keiki events lead up to top cowboys competing for individual and team prizes. Wear your cowboy hats while enjoying local food trucks and a petting zoo. More information at 742-6096 or at KaloaPlantationDays.com.
And mahalo to those folks for supporting Kauai Community Radio. Well, let's see, we're moving on to our next segment in the show, where we'll be talking with Dar Jamal.
Yeah, Dar Jamal is has been on the show with us several times before. He's very famously, actually, an award-winning journalist who went and covered the Iraqi war as an unembedded journalist. I don't know if you can recall, because it's almost a dozen years ago now, but a lot of the reporters, most of the reporters who were covering the Iraqi war were embedded reporters, and that meant that they were sort of working hand in glove with the U.S. forces. They were assigned to each little brigade, and so they were really only able to cover the story from the way that the U.S. military would allow them to cover it. Dar Jamal was an independent journalist. He went there on his own recognizance and went around and covered the stories that he thought were the unreported stories, and covered them his way, and actually started his own career doing all that. He's an award-winning journalist. He's written several books, Beyond the Green Zone, and also The Will to Resist. He's been doing a fair amount of journalism for Truth Out and AlJazeera.net, We're really pleased to have you with us this afternoon, Dar. Thanks again for joining us here on Out of the Box.
Hey, thanks a lot. Always good to be with both of you guys.
Well, we wanted to invite you onto the show today to find out just exactly what is going on in Iraq today. It's been back in the news cycle recently, and it's very confusing and very complicated, and it doesn't sound good. It sounds very bad, most of the news coming out of there. So can you kind of bring us up to speed with what is going on in Iraq?
Well, the extremely encapsulated version of this is that we have to talk about U.S. policy both in Syria and Iraq, because, you know, as everyone knows now, for several years in a row, the story with ISIS starts in Syria. For several years in a row, the U.S. has been pouring a lot of funding and weaponry into rebels in Syria who are against Bashar al-Assad.
You know what? I'm apologize. I want to actually want to back you up a little bit. Before you tell us what's going on and what you understand going on, please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started in this, so that people have an understanding of who you are and who they're listening to. My apologies for getting off on the wrong foot there.
No problem. Sure thing. Well, I got my start in war journalism. I was actually living in Alaska at the time, working as a mountain guide up on Denali, and watching the outrageous propaganda that was used to sell the invasion of Iraq back in 2003, and was completely beside myself with anger at what I was watching happen. You know, basically one of the biggest sell jobs in history being given, you know, war based entirely on lies. And so I decided, well, what's something I could do about this? And so I figured out how to go into Iraq after the invasion had happened, and went in November 2003 on my first trip, and basically hit the ground running and started working as a war journalist, and started just writing my own blog. But then that turned into doing stringer work for various outlets, including the BBC, and then I started writing for a lot more outlets like The Guardian and The Independent and The Nation, and it kind of blossomed from there. So that's how I got my start. But basically, I wanted to give readers back in the United States a real version of what was going on over there, both with the Iraqi people and then later with U.S. military personnel.
Now, do you think you were successful in that? I mean, how do you...
I do. I feel like it's went beyond my wildest expectations, and that I've gotten to write for some of the largest outlets on the planet, and it's turned into two books, and giving hundreds and hundreds of lectures on this all around the world, writing well over 1,000 articles on the topic, and giving well over 1,000 radio and TV interviews on the topic. So I certainly was able to get information out to a rather large audience, actually beyond my wildest dreams, about what was actually happening over there, and still continue to be able to do so thanks to being able to write now for Truth Out.
So I was explaining a moment ago about being an embedded versus an unembedded reporter. Maybe you can explain a little bit more what that's like, what it means, what the difference is between being an independent journalist versus being a dependent journalist.
That's a good way to put it. I like that, because if you decide to embed with the U.S. military, you are actually the definition of a dependent journalist. You're dependent upon them for your safety. You're dependent upon them for what you're going to see, when you're going to see it, and how you're going to see it, and in a lot of instances, even how you're going to report it.
So, yeah, they would censor the reports, yeah?
At times they would. Not all the time, but if it was what they considered extremely sensitive, absolutely they would censor it. And at times I even heard from colleagues who were working even for CNN at the time that they would not allow them to broadcast certain footage. So absolutely, you basically give up your rights as a journalist once you decide to embed. And we got to remember, too, that the embed program was set up deliberately by the U.S. military, well, specifically by the Pentagon, as a means of information control. You can look that up. That is why it was originally created, and it's, of course, served as such very effectively ever since.
Yeah, they didn't like the way the Vietnam War was reported, and they didn't want a repeat of that.
Exactly. That is precisely the genesis of it. They didn't want to be flying people around in helicopters, dropping them into the front lines in bloodbaths and having that come back on American TV set. So
yeah, and they didn't want to have the long train of body bags coming home and being filmed every night as well. It seems like, in a way, they wanted to keep the truth of what was happening from the American people so they could keep on doing it.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. And I think they were pretty largely effective at doing that and keeping the war extremely sanitized. And I think that's another reason why we look at the bloodbath that is Iraq today, which really is the legacy left by the U.S. invasion and occupation, that, you know, most people here remain kind of inert to the news of, you know, seeing what 100, 200, 300 people being killed sometimes on a daily basis over there right now, and it doesn't seem to really move people. And I think that's partially, at least, a result of the sanitation that's occurred in the media.
Well, information control is very important no matter what you're doing. But here we are 12 years later. Perhaps you could give us a quick refresher, kind of block out the main phases of Iraqi Operation Iraqi Liberation, as it was originally called, OIL. They thought, hey, you know what? That's maybe not such a good idea for the name. It sort of says it's Operation Oil.
Gives it all away.
Yeah, so they changed it to Operation Iraqi Freedom. But take us back to 2003 and the 21-day pummeling of the invasion and then what happened since then with the occupation.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned oil. You know, this is, of course, the context of all of it. And, you know, as Robert Fiskin said, if Iraq's chief export was beetroot, we probably wouldn't have gone into that country. So the shock and awe, you know, that we have to mention that, talking about the invasion, where basically Baghdad was hammered with a enormous amount of bombs and missiles, and then, of course, there was very, very little resistance coming into the country when the invasion actually occurred. It was very fast. About 21 days, within 21 days of it launching, the U.S. was coming into Baghdad, and we had the fall of Baghdad on April 8th, and, of course, the infamous pulling down of the Saddam statue on April 9th of 2003. And then that basically, you know, they rolled in. There was little resistance, but that's just because most people there, they weren't happy under Saddam, so most of the military didn't want to fight for him, just like today. Most of the military aren't happy under Maliki, and they won't fight for Maliki, and they're not. So they basically stayed in their homes and waited, and then it was just a few short months later we started to see violent resistance to the U.S. occupation there, and then that only increased with time, and then that sets the stage for a lot of nefarious U.S. machinations, like setting up a death squad, using divide and conquer very effectively. Turning Iraqis against one another so they would stop unifying and fighting against the U.S., which we were seeing happening during 2004. So, you know, but really, in some, you know, and I reported now for over a year in Iraq over several different trips between 2003 and last year, and what I can say is just absolutely one of the largest catastrophes in modern history as far as we're looking at. Well over a million Iraqis have been killed, according to now three scientific studies, several million more displaced, both internally and externally of the country, over 4,000 U.S. military personnel killed, and over 75,000 wounded, either psychologically or physically.
Now, that's actually a really big deal, that 75 or 80,000 casualties, because the U.S. Medical services were so vastly improved over the Vietnam era. They were often able to medevac people completely out of the theater back to Germany and get pretty high-level medical attention. So that doesn't stop you from dying, but it takes a lot of people who would have died, and they're like vegetables today.
That's exactly right, and that's why we see the VA, you know, that's always in the news. I mean, it has been since the beginning of this, and it's still in the news for its incompetency and the fact that they have waiting lists of soldiers trying to get treatment that they were promised and owed by the government, and literally large numbers of them dying on the waiting list because the VA is so inept at getting people in and getting them the treatment and help that they need. And it's precisely some of it because of what you just mentioned, that they have severe physical issues.
Brain trauma, a lot of brain trauma, soft tissue damage.
TBI, traumatic brain trauma, traumatic brain injury, rather, loads of post-traumatic stress disorder, on top of physical ailments, people needing massive amounts of therapy.
But we can come back to some of that more in a little bit. But I just wanted to kind of ask you, what was your main take on all that experience that came before now to set the stage for now? And then I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what's going on today, set the stage for that.
I think in some, just to really reiterate how large of a tragedy it is for the Iraqi people after, they went through the Iran-Iraq war for 10 years almost in the 80s, and then they had a brief respite, and then the first Gulf War, followed by 12 years of genocidal sanctions, as they were referred to by people like Hans von Spanek, who were in the UN overseeing them at the parts of them at the time. And then now this bloody occupation, and then of course leaving the country in the state it is in today, which is basically a state of total disintegration. It's the Iraq, the tragedy that's been visited upon the Iraqi people who have said, look, the oil is our curse. We wish we didn't even have it because we know that that's why all this has taken place.
So here we are today. We've got a failed state, total chaos, sectarian civil war, and this brand new ultra breed of jihadis who are running rampant across the Iraq in the north and in the west. That seems like a very complicated, messy situation, but you're not there today. So how do you get your information today? How do you know what's going on there? Who are your trusted sources?
Well, I still stay in contact with several interpreters that I've worked with in there, and they're in different parts of Iraq. One is in Fallujah, one is from Fallujah but is now in Amman, and then a couple of guys I know in Baghdad. And so I stay in really good touch with them, and of course, since they're there and they're the ones on the ground and have family in other parts of Iraq, I trust their information over anything that anybody else can find online. So I stay in contact with them, as well as the fact that I was in there last year, just about a year ago now, and was in Fallujah, in Baghdad, and all across southern Iraq, and was watching develop then the genesis of what we see today of a completely disenfranchised Sunni population, Maliki, of course, being Shia, being head of the Dawah Party from Iran, spent 8 years of his life in Tehran, actually, and so has, from the beginning of him taking power, basically taken the fight to the Sunnis and tried to disenfranchise them and not giving them any kind of traction politically in Baghdad whatsoever. So you have this huge several million portion of the population completely politically disenfranchised, while a government that is attacking them relentlessly on a daily basis, detaining them, home raids, killing them, raping their women. And I was there a year ago watching this pot of rage start to boil over, attacks on the government forces start to step up, seeing ISIS start to get a foothold within different parts of Anbar province. And that was made possible because of the brutal government tactics against the young Sunni population who were, when I was there a year ago, basically chomping at the bit to take the fight to Baghdad.
Yeah, it's it sounds like it's a big chaotic mess. It sounds like it's a failed state, and you really have to sort of wonder, well, how did this come about? How did this seemingly terrible situation, how did this occur? I know that back in 2003, there were literally 36 million people around the world protesting this war before it started because they thought it was a terrible idea. I know that from poll numbers back in 2003, that almost two-thirds of the American population thought it was a bad idea, didn't want to go to war, and thought that the likely result of that effort would be more terrorism and a more chaotic situation. But it's really easy I think to look back in hindsight, you know, they say hindsight is 20/20, but it's more interesting, I think, to listen to some people who made predictions about this even before that. So we've got an audio clip here we're going to go to, and this is Mr. Dick Cheney speaking in 1994 about what the likely outcome would be of large-scale U.S. military action.
Do you think that U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west. Part of eastern Iraq the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take over Iraq. The other thing was casualties. Everyone was impressed with the fact that we were able to do our job with as few casualties as we had. But for the 146 Americans killed in action and for their families, it wasn't a cheap war. And the question for the president in terms of whether or not we went on to Baghdad and took additional casualties in an effort to get Saddam Hussein was how many additional dead Americans is Saddam worth? And our judgment was not very many, and I think we got it right.
So what Dick Cheney there is saying is that he has actually a pretty clear understanding that if U.S. forces go in there and bomb the bejesus out of everything, that the likely result will be chaos, quagmire, and kind of unmitigated disaster for everyone and for all different kinds of reasons and aspects. And it turns out that was exactly what did happen. I think it really asks the question, is the present mess in Iraq today, is that the failure of a policy, or are we really looking at failure by design?
It's a tough question. I mean, absolutely, it was, I think, abject failure of policy. I mean, the Bush administration, I mean, this has all come out, and they actually were very open. Paul Wolfowitz said, look, we fit the propaganda for this war around the policy, that we were going in, and we knew we were going in, and we basically got the information that we needed and found the right people to say what we wanted to say, people like Ahmed Shalabi, who's now being considered for the next prime minister of Iraq.
Yeah, like round two.
Right.
For Ahmed.
Told them, yeah, you're going to be welcome with flowers. The Iraqis are going to love you. And, you know, just telling, you know, so all this could be broadcast across the national media in the U.S. And so they rolled in basically only listening to what they wanted to hear, making it happen. Anyone within the Bush administration, I mean, there were several key generals who were voicing concern before the invasion. They were, of course, replaced immediately. So that's how they rolled, and that's how they got away with this. And so I think it's clearly they basically just wanted to believe what they needed to believe in order to get the military placed within Baghdad and start the machinations to get their hands on the Iraqi oil. But now we have a situation where, is it by design? It's tough to say, because, you know, we have Joe Biden, who's been on record several years ago, not that long after the invasion, actually, talking about when things started to go south in Iraq, mentioning the breaking Iraq into three sectors, a Kurdish, a Sunni, and then a Shia, sort of three rump states out of what the country is today. So there's certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence that points towards, wow, maybe this wasn't the worst all along. But I personally, as a journalist, I would need a lot more hard documents in my hand and that kind of hard evidence to really start saying, yeah, this was absolutely by design. That while there is anecdotal evidence, I just haven't seen enough hard evidence yet to say that. But certainly we can point directly towards a policy that was abject failure.
Right. Well, I just am observing that the outcomes from the actions taken were very closely matching exactly what the policymakers said they would be. So we may never know about that, or it may take some time to actually get the details on that. But
well, that clip was from 94. And
yeah.
They were defending their decision of a couple of years ago
right.
not to invade Baghdad. They weren't saying they weren't going to do it in the future. They were just trying to answer critics at that time why they hadn't done it yet.
Right. Well, but if you listen to Dick Cheney, he said, we're not going to do it for these reasons, because if we did it, A, B, and C would happen. Turns out, down the road a little bit, they go ahead and do exactly those things. And then, gosh, what do you know?
Right.
Exactly what he said would happen. So, yeah, it's. I think it will be interesting as more files become declassified to find out a little bit more about how that happened. But at any rate, here we are now. We had a civil war in Syria. We've got the Maliki government, which you've been describing to us as, not very popularly supported. I think that's a safe assessment. Where is ISIS from? How did they get bankrolled into existence? And what are they trying to accomplish? What is up with ISIS?
ISIS is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Also, you'll hear them referred to as the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. There's different iterations of that, and these are the English translations of it, not what they call themselves in Arabic. But they are a radical jihadi group that are fundamentally even more radical than Al-Qaeda. They have existed on the ground in Iraq for the last several years, looking to recruit from the angry young Sunni population that I described earlier. And as Maliki's tactics continued to worsen, you know, the Sunnis started protesting every Friday against Maliki in nonviolent demonstrations from late 2012. And then Maliki's response was, as they progressed, to basically start gunning down Sunnis. And that escalated by the middle of last year. I was in there at one of the protests, and on the same day, there was I was in Fallujah, and there was a protest in Ramadi where government forces opened fire on protesters and killed several people. And that was supposed to be the last protest before they were, basically tribal leaders were going to allow violence to start taking place against government forces. So the stage has been set. Maliki's own tactics were the biggest recruiting drive for ISIS, forcing more and more of the younger Sunni population into them. Also, simultaneous to that, we have what's going on in Syria, where the U.S. is dumping massive amounts of arms and weapons, along with Qatar and Saudi Arabia, into rebel groups there against Bashar al-Assad, him being Alawite and Shia, and of course these rebel groups being predominantly Sunni, and the more radical, the better in a lot of ways for the U.S., Qatar, Saudi Arabia, because they're the fighters that are willing to die for the cause. And even Kerry went on record recently saying, yep, the most radical ones happen to be the best fighters on the ground. So the U.S., I don't think necessarily intentionally meant for these arms and money to go into the hands of ISIS in Syria, but that is what happened and what continues to happen. So ISIS in Iraq, that was growing in strength, started coordinating with ISIS groups in Syria who control large swaths of the country, are already pulling revenue from the areas that they control. And then they coordinate this lightning flash attack in Iraq that was so successful predominantly because they already had such a strong hold in places like Kalafar, Mosul, Fallujah, Ramadi, Samarra, Tikrit, et cetera. So the stage has been set by U.S. policy by supporting Maliki in Baghdad. They've given him over $25 billion of arms and training.
Wait. $25
billion? Yeah, $25 billion and counting. Of course, now they're trying to rush 4,000 more Hellfire missiles in, more weaponry, and sending more trainers and quote-unquote advisors in there. There's at least 600 in there. I think the number's probably higher, but that the Pentagon admits to is 600. So
this is 600 U.S. troops into Iraq right now?
In Baghdad,
okay.
Right. And some of them already slated to be flying attack helicopters. And the Pentagon's pushing for them to have more, quote-unquote, flexibility in their mission on the ground so they can get more involved. So right now this is looking like an escalation. But, you know, to finish up about ISIS, the great irony of it, we really have literally a modern-day catch-22 where you've got, intentionally or not, is arguable, but you've got the U.S. funding and arming ISIS on one side in Syria and funding and arming Maliki on the other side in Baghdad.
Hmm. Well, that wouldn't be the first time that the U.S. has done that. They, in the whole Iraq-Iran war, funded both sides, armed both sides, and had a splendid war going on there for 6 or 7 years, I think. They were, and it seemed like they were happy to have that go on maybe till forever. But I'm speculating. I don't really know that. What I have read recently is reports that 30,000 Saudi troops have mobilized to the southern Iraqi border, and I've heard reports about skirmishes taking place with Iranian troops over on the Iranian-Iraqi border. I've also heard that NATO up in Turkey, because Turkey is a NATO member state, that they're trying to figure out their force posture to the violence that's occurring to the south of them. What are the next likely things to happen? Where are we going with all this?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I think as long as the U.S. continues to dump money and arms and other support into the rebels in Syria, it's fuel on that fire, which means it's fuel on the Iraq fire, as I just described, as to why. And then, of course, as the U.S. continues to support Maliki, although they are calling for him to be removed and replaced with someone else, but even if that does happen, they clearly are on a trajectory where they've got hundreds of troops in Baghdad, possibly more coming, helicopters, Hellfire missiles, more
drones.
So they're, yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. A lot of drones, probably more coming. So whether Maliki stays or goes, you've got them dumping massive amounts of fuel on the fire from that side as well. So certainly I think we can expect it to continue to escalate and violence to continue across broad swaths of the country. As you just mentioned, it's already spilling outside the borders. I've had reports of Syrian airstrikes happening in northern Iraq and villages there. Certainly there's been Israeli airstrikes in Syria on top of what you just described. So it's already essentially turning into a regional war, at least around the border areas of Iraq, which are becoming more obscure by the day.
Well, it does seem like if you throw gasoline onto a fire, it might just bloom a little bigger. We're going to take a quick musical break. We're speaking with Dar Jamel, independent journalist and author, about what is going on in Iraq, what is up with ISIS. You're listening to KKCR Out of the Box with Dave Giroux and Jonathan Jay. We'll be back in just a moment.
But just like the peace of hands that vanished in our dreams, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's a winter. It's winter in America. Know it's winter. Lord knows it's winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting, cause nobody knows what to say. Save your soul from a winter in America.
Thanks for tuning in, and welcome back to Out of the Box here on KKCR. We're talking with independent journalist and author Dar Jamel, the author of The Will to Resist, soldiers who refuse to fight, and also beyond the green zone, firsthand reportage from the Iraqi invasion and occupation. Well, we've been talking a lot about what happens when you throw gasoline onto a fire. You seem to pretty consistently get an even bigger blaze. Perhaps the fundamentals of the policy that we've been pursuing as the U.S., and I don't mean you and I don't mean me when I say we, perhaps the U.S. military policy doesn't need tinkering or edits around the margin. Perhaps the whole approach to interacting with the world is fundamentally flawed. Perhaps more violence just begets more violence. How can we regain our balance and begin to turn away from this fundamentally militaristic and violent way of interacting with the world? You know, all these bombs, all this oppression, all this quest for oil, it really damages people. It hurts society. It rips the fabric of society apart and chops it into little pieces. And I've heard it said that war is not good for children or pets or people. How have you handled? How do you respond? How have you begun to heal from the actually horrible and traumatic things that you've experienced in covering the conflict?
Well, I think the most challenging part, especially covering a war, is holding on to your own humanity, because war is dehumanizing, and the types of policies that we're seeing in the U.S. and other Western countries around the globe force upon other people, mainly corporate capitalism and everything that goes along with it, is it's inherently dehumanizing. And so I think the first thing any of us have to do is do what we need to do to kind of stay in touch with our own humanity. And, you know, if bottom line is if we're sitting here at our desk reading the news on a daily basis and can read about a day in Iraq where 250 people are killed across the country and not feel any emotions, then clearly we're already very dehumanized, and we need to do something about that. And that's exactly what happened to me when I was overseas. That's what soldiers have to contend with when they come back home as well. And anyone else who's been over there, whether they're a journalist or a soldier or a contractor or anybody in any capacity. So for me, it's meant taking a little breather from it, and obviously I'm privileged enough to be able to step out of it and do that, unlike Iraqis who can't leave their own country, most of them, and find ways to do that and take some breaks, take some news fast, get outside into nature, that kind of thing, and really do what I need to do to take care of myself and give myself a break to get my humanity back. Because if I'm not able to connect with things on an emotional basis and stay in touch with my own morality about what's right and wrong, which are things that basically get obliterated during wartime, then I'm not going to really be of much use to anybody else, let alone myself.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the soldiers that you've met and interviewed, in terms of how they grew and changed from their combat experience and resolved to make a change.
Well, I ran into enough soldiers. I was inspired to do a second book called The Will to Resist, and it was about soldiers I was meeting who were refusing to partake anymore of this corporate policy because they saw themselves being used as little more than pawns and cannon fodder in this policy of basically corporatism, which meant invading and destroying more countries. So folks like the Halliburtons and the Raytheons and the other weapons manufacturers could turn a huge profit. And they started basically refusing to go. I mean, at the height of the Iraq War, we had over 60,000 soldiers who'd gone AWOL from that conflict alone, not even talk about, Afghanistan. And they started overtly speaking out, many of them, about the policies they were seeing, and started things like Iraq Veterans Against the War and other types of offshoots of that, of rather large, sometimes several thousand soldiers at a time, banding together, challenging U.S. policy, challenging the fact that the government wasn't backing the VA enough to give soldiers the care they needed when they came back, and really, as veterans who have a lot of clout and how people take them seriously and listen to them, using that voice and using that political leverage to have more of a voice in the media and a voice against the government for the policies that they saw in acting and refusing to participate in.
We had a caller called in a moment ago and was asking for you to clarify a little bit about the role of oil in the war. Not so much so I think about, like, was oil a factor, but more so how can we as citizens of an industrialized Western economy, how can we change our relationship to oil to perhaps reduce some of the drive to go take that from other countries?
Well, certainly, I mean, it might, in the grand scheme of things, seem like a pittance, and probably because it is, but I think all of us are, I'll just speak for myself, I feel morally obliged to use as little as possible. So that means riding my bike everywhere, and fortunately I live somewhere where I can do that, and minimize my use of oil and gas and other resources, anything that basically requires money. So use solar for power at my house, which I do, and these sorts of things. So I think anything we can do to minimize feeding the beast, as one way to put it, is something that we can certainly do, and certainly just use less resources, spend more money, feed the machine less. And it does seem such a small thing, but if more and more of us can start to do that, it certainly can't hurt.
Well, presently, the U.S. Pentagon budget is right around $800 billion a year, and we could easily cut $500 billion out of that, and we would still be spending $300 billion a year. We still would have the largest, most awesome military on the planet, but we would also have an extra $1 trillion available to suddenly do other things. What are some examples you think are perhaps the most pressing unmet human, social, and environmental needs that are unaddressed today? Some of the real human, social, and environmental crises.
Absolutely, we should be having a wartime response to climate change, and I think part of that would look like getting away from the fossil fuel industry, less extraction, certainly by default less burning, and then dumping massive amounts of that budget that you just described into building as many renewable resources as possible, like solar everywhere where it's feasible, wind, and then investigating new technologies to use along those lines, renewable as well as education programs in schools and to the general public about how to conserve more energy and live closer to the ground.
Yeah, because really it's about breaking our addiction to oil and our need to consume.
Exactly.
So what's next for you, Dar Jamel? Where are you going to put your energies next?
I am still writing about Iraq, just because I it's a story that's near and dear to me. But the brunt of my reporting now is actually on climate change and environmental issues. Obviously, climate change I think it's a no-brainer. It's the biggest story any of us, as a journalist, are going to look at for the rest of our lives, and it's only becoming increasingly so with each passing day. So I will continue to report primarily on that and continue my work, thankfully, writing for Truth Out at truthout.org.
When you talk about the effects of global warming or climate change, what do you see as some of the biggest effects that are going to happen sooner and have the greatest effects in the short term?
Well, we're already seeing those over here on the mainland, where if you look at the California drought, this is a great example of driving food prices up across the country, where you have, you know, this is an area where we get such a huge percentage of our fruit and vegetables and nuts, and we're seeing prices of everything go up. We're seeing water starting to become a huge factor, communities and even interstate battles for water in the courts. And then, of course, you see other superstorms like Sandy that hit the Northeast and did so much damage in New York and New Jersey. So these types of extreme weather events continuing to escalate, droughts, wildfire season that's now year-round in several states where there used to be an actual season. So these are some of the things that are immediately evident. And I think the next big thing that we'll see that is a siren is going to be the fact that we're looking at an ice-free Arctic. We're going to have a small portion of the summer ice-free, a total ice-free Arctic ice cap, probably by next summer, and if not then, probably the year after if current trajectories continue, both on the amount of fossil fuels being burned and, of course, their impacts on the atmosphere and the planet.
Well, some people would say that could be a good thing because it opens up new shipping lanes and you can go from point A to point B using less resources. But I'm thinking perhaps there's some other negative consequences.
Well, considering approximately 80% of the world's population lives either on the coast or not very far distance from it, and we're already looking at, according to NASA, minimum sea level rise of 3 to 4 feet by the end of this century, you can kind of do the math economically and start thinking, well, maybe this isn't going to be such a good idea if we're going to continue rising sea levels and making places like Miami, one of the bigger financial hubs on the planet, and New York, for example, underwater.
Yeah, that will be problematic.
Slightly.
Well, Dar, I want to thank you so much for speaking with us today. Really appreciate the opportunity to hear your perspective. I've never been to Iraq. I don't have translators and fixers that I've developed working relationships with. I'm stuck here inside the empire trying to wade my way through whatever the media lets slip by in. So I really appreciate being able to speak with you from your direct experience, your lived experience and what you saw with your own eyes. I think it's very valuable.
Well, thanks to both you guys. It's always great to be with you. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, hope you come out here and visit us here sometime soon.
I'd love to.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you, guys.
Aloha.
Take care.
That was Dar Jamel, independent journalist and author of several books, Beyond the Green Zone, a kind of a documentation about downtown Baghdad and the difference between what was happening there and the rest of the chaotic country. The Green Zone, if you recall, was sort of like the safer zone inside the security perimeter. But, yeah, kind of a mess.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's too bad they had to go. I was hoping to open up the phone lines and get some people calling in or give the opportunity people call in and discuss it with them directly. But
well, folks certainly
he had to go.
Yeah, he had to go. But you can absolutely call in at 826-7771 if you have a comment on what we were speaking about. Love to hear from you how this all strikes you. Maybe some of this is old hat for you, or maybe this is information that you have never come across before.
Yeah, there's talking about one of the winners of the wars over there is the military-industrial complex, and I saw some interesting statistics on some military spending. Have you heard of the F-35?
I have. That's the new
Joint Strike Fighter Lightning II.
Yeah, that's the new multi-force strike aircraft. That's the new standard platform.
Evidently, it's a dog, and It's not flying very well. It's $135 to $200 million per plane.
Hmm.
They want to buy 2,400 of them over the next 20 years.
What does that add up to?
$1.5 trillion.
Oh, that's a trillion here, a trillion there. Yeah. Pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Yeah, and so that's enough money that they could buy every homeless person in the United States a $600,000 home.
Wow.
With that money.
That wow.
And then or hire every unemployed person in the country for a $50,000 job.
That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, but evidently this
actually, I really like those two options. Those seem very attractive.
Yeah, would have been a much better way to spend that
well,
money.
Well, and so we would get that for free as long as we don't have the airplane that doesn't work very well?
Yeah, see, it doesn't work very well. It's been wrought with a lot of problems. One just burned, the engine burned up like 6 days ago. They grounded the whole fleet. They are in a fleet of
maybe it's called
flock,
a murder
flock of them.
A murder of F-35s.
Yeah, right. And in simulations against Russian MiGs and Chinese aircraft, it did not do very well. The Chinese aircraft particularly just flew circles around it and blew them all up.
Hmm. Well, that's, that sounds kind of bad. And especially, you know, all the different forces, all the different applications, all the different types of missions. I mean, it sounds like if you're going to design one aircraft to meet all of those capabilities, it's kind of like flying around in a gigantic Leatherman tool where it doesn't do any of the individual things that well. It does all of them sort of okay, but none of them very well.
It drops bombs okay, but, you know, heaven forbid they get into a dogfight with another plane from another country there, because it's not going to do very well.
Hmm.
I think we have a call on the phone. Let's go to the phones.
Aloha, caller. Welcome to Out of the Box here on KKCR. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, well, let me see now. I am very, very pleased that you two young men are discussing U.S. Militarism.
You're really into this F-35, I'll bet.
Well, the thing is that war is a big part of the U.S. capitalist economy, and you've got to get away from it. And the thing is that, you know, like last night I went to the candidates forum, and there's a lot of discussion about the government, you know, not having money, you know, squandering of funds. Well, you know, most of our direct treasure, national treasure, goes to the military. And this is what we got to start questioning about, because a lot of the problems that we have, unemployment, housing, energy, transportation, a lot
Keep going. That's actually a long list.
Yeah,
don't stop now.
A lot of these problems can be dealt with much more effectively if we start cutting the military budget, slashing it. You know, like, for example, you know, getting rid of the over 1,000 military bases around the world, including...
Well, wait a second, caller.
Hawaii.
Wait a second. How are you going to dominate the world if you don't have military bases everywhere?
Well, you know, too bad. You know, other countries have a right to control their own destinies, like Okinawa, Jeju, Korea. Here in Hawaii, we have a right to control our own destiny without the military destroying a lot of our natural resources and our land.
I've always been curious about that Guantanamo Bay.
On Cuban soil.
Last time I checked, Cuba and the U.S. didn't really get along that well. And, you know, I wonder, would it be okay with Americans if Cuba had a military base, say, in, you know, outside of D.C. somewhere?
Yeah, with a torture facility.
With a torture facility and a bunch of people locked up without any legal...
That's right, without any freedoms and legal rights. But, you know, like, for example, a lot of the politicians, especially the ruling party, which is the Democratic Party, they called PMRF, they called the militarism that we have in the Pacific and around the world, they call them jewels, you know. And they're not jewels, you know. They're completely destructive, like Dar Jamal was saying, and it's a waste of lives and a waste of resources. And we have to start changing the paradigm of our thinking. You know, people have to start questioning what's going on with America's priorities, and militarism has got to go. And we can solve a lot of the economic problems that we have in this country by redirecting our national budget towards the needs of the people and
now,
getting it away from war.
A week or two ago, we had a debate between Colleen Hanabusa and who was the
Brian Schatz.
And they basically said the same thing.
Yeah, they were falling over each other. Who's going to support the military more? Who's going to expand PMRF more? You know, they're taking more buffer zone around it in case they needed to expand later.
Yeah, right. And, you know, Korea is a big threat. Korea's missiles.
Yeah, you know, I hear that over and over again, but I don't really understand how,
it's the same thing like how they played up with Saddam, you know, that he's this big threat in the Middle East, and that's what they're going to try to do. They're going to try to play up Korea as the big threat in the Pacific region. And, you know, now they're trying, like what you said, getting Japan to be one of their more active partners in this controlling the Pacific militarily. And last night, the politicians, they don't have this understanding. Most of them don't really understand Hawaii's role in the Pacific, which is to protect U.S. interests and to get even more. And we have to, like, for example, there has to be a debate within the Democratic Party you know, among the progressives within the party to start really questioning militarism.
Well, there was a debate between Hanabusa and Schatz, and they were debating with each other about who could be more supportive of military expenditures.
And well, you know, Hanabusa did come out and say that basically...
I thought she won, by the way.
Anyway, but the super ferry, she was mentioning how it is being used by the military today, you know, and it's being used in I believe, in Okinawa, you know, and one of the ships. And she was saying that we should bring back the super ferry for military purposes and stuff, as well as for taking care of these, helping with disasters and stuff. But we got to remember about Hanabusa. She's the one that pushed for the special session. Remember that on the super ferry? But not once did she bring that up in her debate, that she wasted a lot of our money on some frivolous thing like that, which the lawsuit threw out.
One thing I do like about her record is that she really opposes military action around the world, you know, in terms of...
Really?
As a first measure of solving problems there, you know.
Hmm.
But
I'm not aware of that. I know that she's on the Congressional Drone Committee. That's something I know about her.
Well, you know, like, for example, when there was a question asked of them, you know, about the embassy, Hanabusa did say, just get out of there, you know, while Schatz saying defend the embassy. And so that's one of the rationales today for the U.S. sending in more troops, you know, more of these supposed advisors, you know, that are operating helicopters and other instruments of war, you know, to protect the embassy. So to protect American lives. So the best thing to do is to get out, you know, and stop funding this Maliki government, Dar Jamal was saying. So the problem is continuing, and so the Democratic Party, you know, what happens is that these politicians start cutting a lot of stuff. People start getting laid off. They have a sequestration and furloughs and wage cuts and all kinds of things. But in actuality, the funds, the money is there to help out the people, but it's just being redirected towards the wrong things. You know, so the funding is there to help the people out. And we have to start discussing those kinds of things.
Really? That's what you think we should do? We should discuss it?
Yeah, we have to discuss those kinds of things. You know what I mean? Because the country is not broke. I mean, let's face it, man. The money is going to the wrong places.
Hmm.
You know, like Mr. Like Bruce Hay. You remember you asked him, the military commander over at PRMRF. You asked him, he said, if you didn't have to spend this money on militarism, on weapons, what would you do? And he said public transportation, right?
Yeah. He said he felt that we had unmet needs in public transportation. I thought that was actually the coolest thing I heard him say. I thought that was right on.
Well, that was a great question that you had for him, you know, and I'm glad the way you had him on the show. Some people said maybe you were throwing those softballs at him, but if you attack the guy, he won't come on the show and talk.
Well, I think the point you were raising about having a serious discussion about these important issues, it's gotta begin at some point, and I believe that all conversations must begin with respect, or else they're not going to go anywhere.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but and so it respects works both ways, especially. And you know, we're not a bunch of fringe crazies, you know, asking these kinds of questions.
It is extreme. Well, I'm not.
Yeah. Well, you know, like for example, I belong to the HGEA, Hawaii Government Employees Association, and whenever I would bring up questions about militarism and the military budget, you know, because I was a public worker, and you know, public workers were facing layoffs and all kinds of cuts in our pensions and everything else. I said these problems can be solved if we would direct our national budget towards the needs of the people. They don't even want to listen to it. You know, they kind of like avoid it as much as possible.
Which is really odd, because as a person, you would think that they would be interested in having human needs be met, because
exactly
that would actually serve
but they're
them.
Not gonna, yeah, but they're not going to touch it because they're closely allied with Obama administration, which really supports the military around the world, right? So there's all these connections and stuff. But we have to start changing the paradigm and start changing the discussion. That's why this panel discussion that's happening over at CAPA on Saturday at the public library is really important, Oceans for Peace.
Yeah, do you have the time again for that?
Well, yeah, well, let me see. Now, so that's going to be on this coming Saturday, and that's going to be from 5 to 7 o'clock, and that's being put on by the Coalition Oceans for Peace.
And this is at the Kapaa Public Library, is that correct?
Yeah, the Kapaa Public Library. I think an individual called up earlier and was talking about the event. But that's why we got to have these kinds of events. We have to start redirecting the discussion. You know, we got to start getting away from the idea that ROTC is good, you know, that joining the military is going to solve employment. You know, we got to start really opening this question up to make people understand that militarism, the military-industrial complex, is one of the biggest problems that we have.
Yeah, it's tricky because, you know, right now it seems like it's the only game in town. So
Yeah, exactly it. But it's not easy to do. I know that. I know it's not easy to do. But somehow we have to start raising these kinds of things and let people know what's going on. It's not easy to do at all, but I'm glad that you guys are doing it on your show.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Appreciate that.
And Dr. Jamil came to Hawaii a few years back, and he was very informative. Who knows, one day we may be able to have him back again. But people need to know what's going on in the Middle East, what America did to destroy Iraq, how it's destroying Afghanistan, and how it's going to be destroying the Pacific region with all these war games and potential conflicts that it's going to start up.
Well, thank you for calling in and sharing your views on that. I really appreciate your mana'o.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having Dr. Jamil on and talking about U.S. imperialism. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Aloha.
Bye.
Well, we're kind of coming towards the close of the show here. We've got Acoustic Luau coming up at 6.
One
should be a good show. Definitely stick around for that. We got a special DJ host this evening for that.
Yeah, I was hoping to get to discuss a little bit about what's going on in Palestine right now, the assault on Gaza and the West Bank by the Israeli mad dog Netanyahu. It's a very difficult situation for the Palestinians, and the U.S. military is providing cover for the Israelis there. Very difficult situation there that we'll talk about that in the next show.
There was some youth who were beat up, I believe murdered.
They were murdered, yeah.
Yeah,
but nobody knows who did it. But
there's rocket launching, there's airstrikes. It's not good.
Yeah, I saw one thing on ABC News. Diane Sawyer was talking about how the Palestinians were shooting rockets into Israel, and now the siren air raid sirens were going off and them like that, and they're showing them, you know, pulling dead babies out of the rubble there. But in reality, those were the Palestinian family that was getting their dead babies out of their rubble. It was not the Israelis.
Yeah.
So they're totally misrepresenting the whole situation.
You know, I'll just give you my two cents on that. I don't think it's good to be killing anybody's babies.
That's right. Okay, well, that's it for the show. Thanks for all the calls, and thanks for Dar Jamil for calling in. And stay tuned for the Acoustic Luau coming up next. Going to go out with little Joni Mitchell.
Aloha, everybody. I'll be back in September going to Turkey and Italy, and I'll take notes and bring back some firsthand reportage from the rest of the world.
Aloha.
Give peace a chance. That was just a dream some of us had. Still a lot of lands to see, but I wouldn't want to stay here. It's too old and cold and settled in its ways here. Oh, but California, California, I'm coming home. I'm gonna see the folks I dig. I'll even kiss a sunset pig. California, when I get home. Met a redneck on a Grecian isle who did the goat dance very well. He gave me back my smile, but he kept my camera to sell. Oh, the rogue, the red, red rogue. He cooked good omelettes and stews, and I might have stayed on with him there, but my heart cried out for you. California, oh, California, I'm coming home. Oh, make me feel good rock and roll band. I'm
I'm your biggest fan. California, I'm coming home. Oh, it gets so lonely when you're walking and the streets are full of strangers. All the news are home. You read, just give you the blues. A plane to Spain, went to a party down a red dirt road. There were lots of pretty people there, reading Rolling Stone, reading Vogue. They said, how long can you hang around? I said, a week, maybe two, just until my skin turns brown. Then I'm going home to California. Oh, California, I'm coming home. Oh, will you take me as I am, strung out on another man? California.